Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to CoHealth Checkup, a 30-minute radio show that promises thoughtful debate and lively banter about workplace wellness and employee benefits trends. I'm Fran Melmed, the founder of Context, a communication consulting firm that specializes in workplace wellness, and one of your co-hosts. You can find me on Twitter at F.E. Melmed and online at contextcommunication.com. I'm joined by my co-host, Carol Harnett.
Hi, Fran, and good morning, everyone. As Fran said, I'm Carol Harnett, and I'm a health, disability, and employee benefits consultant, and I also speak and write in those spaces. I also am the president for the Council for Disability Awareness, and you can find me at the Twitter handle at Carol Harnett and also at Human Resource Executive, where I write the employee benefits column.
Great. So earlier in April, Carol and I were out in Las Vegas for the Human Resource Executive Health and Benefits Leadership Conference, where Carol moderated an opening session on health and financial well-being, and I moderated a separate panel. We couldn't help but note how financial well-being as a theme continued to thread itself through the many sessions over the 2 days of the conference. But what exactly is financial well-being? You know, it wasn't clear to us over the course of those 2 days. Is it knowing that your basics are covered and that there's something left over for pleasure? Is it a retirement paved with gold and flourished with that lovely umbrella drink we all imagine comes with retirement? The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau defines financial well-being as feeling in control, having the capacity to absorb a financial shock, being on track to meet goals, and possessing the flexibility to make choices. Beyond that, though, there's really little consensus about the definition. So Carol and I decided right there in Vegas to create a series devoted to exploring financial well-being. And I can't help but reflect that actually being in Vegas was probably a really interesting place to make this decision. So today's show marks the first episode of our series, and we're going to begin with a discussion about retirement planning. For many of us, retirement is a goal for which we feel financially and otherwise ill-prepared. According to a 2013 Towers Watson survey of over 4,000 retirement plan participants, almost 3 in 5 United States workers are worried about their financial future. Some data from the Federal Reserve could shed some light on why that is. According to their data, the median balance of retirement accounts for those, and this is for those who are saving, actually, for retirement is less than $60,000. While the Employee Benefits Research Institute in its 25th annual Retirement Confidence Survey found people start taking steps to ensure security the closer they get to retirement age, the savings obviously may start a little too late. EBRI found that only 18% are confident about having enough money for retirement, which might be why the percentages planning to retire at age 66 or older have increased steadily for every age group. So CoHealth Checkup wants to welcome Lori Rowley, the co-founder and president of the National Association of Retirement Plan Participants, to our show today to help us make sense of what's going on here. Why don't we do a better job preparing for retirement? How can we do better? And what impact does our preparedness or lack thereof have on our financial well-being? Lori's nonprofit organization, which goes by the acronym NARP, uses research, coalitions, and education to make financial information transparent and universally accessible with the hopes of helping 145 million working Americans save for retirement. Lori, let me welcome you to CoHealth Checkup.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. It's a great topic, and I'm thrilled that you guys have decided to dedicate some shows on it. So thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Lori. And I, as Fran referenced, moderated the opening session of the Human Resource Executive Conference. And one of the techniques I use when I moderate panels is to actually allow the audience to participate by text messaging me questions throughout the session. And it was fascinating. I had over 200 questions that were text messaged in, but over a dozen of them expressed concern about the almost complete focus on retirement planning when we're discussing financial well-being. And there were calls in these text messages and questions that came later for a broader focus on financial planning that included employee benefits choices that address financial risks such as short and long-term disabilities and long-term care needs, in addition to the retirement discussion. So, Lori, we'd like to start off with, because as Fran alluded, there really doesn't feel to be, for lack of a better term, a clean definition of financial well-being. So I've got a two-part request. first, could you give us your definition of financial well-being? And then coupled to that, can you tell us your thoughts on whether retirement planning should be coupled into a larger focus around income protection planning, such as making sure you have short and long-term disability and long-term care? Because the absence of those things could potentially have an enormous impact on a person's retirement.
Yes, I'm going to try and tackle both of those questions. Wow. So first of all, in terms of my definition of financial well-being, I mean, it's some version really of what you mentioned earlier from the Consumer Financial Protection Organization about people being in control of their finances and being able to make informed choices, whatever those choices may be. In a way that's beneficial to them and helps them achieve their goals. And that's sort of the broad working definition. When you drill down a little bit deeper in terms of how does that play out, actually the two-part question you asked is really important because one leads into the other. So if we define financial well-being as being able to be in control of your financial decisions and making informed financial decisions, which means understanding your choices, that impacts how you think about your entire financial life, which includes retirement savings. I think that there's so much focus on retirement savings because it's obviously one of the largest and most impactful financial decisions that one ever has to make. So we're basically in a position these days where every individual has to be their own pension manager, which means you have to initiate, maintain, and grow a lifetime savings that will support you in your retirement, whatever definition of retirement you may have. It still needs to support you in some fashion. And I think for a long time, the retirement industry has really just focused on getting people to just save. It's been a really ineffective strategy because people can't just save money. It's not just enough to say, oh, people just need to save more. People want to make informed financial decisions, but they don't know how to do it in the context of their entire financial life. So we have to stop looking at people as sort of segments of different types of products and services that involve their financial life and start looking at them more holistically. You know, if somebody isn't saving and they're not saving enough for retirement, I don't think it's an effective strategy to just say, you're not doing enough, you need to do more. You know, you're not taking these benefits that we're making available. I think you have to start to say, okay, why is it that you're not doing this? Are there other problems with debt? Are there other problems with, you know, a myriad of financial issues that are going on?
Lori, I love this because one of the things that you know, my husband and I always laugh about is when you ask somebody, well, how much should I save? Just save as much as you can. I don't know what that means.
Right.
So in diving into this a little bit and in readying for the show, I was looking at some research that NARP has done with Professor Keller of Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. This professor in 2013 researched a decision-making model called Enhanced Active Choice, or EAC. And as I understand it, EIC helps to guide people to the optimal decision, not through opt-out or other default mechanics that we're looking at or are currently in use, but by highlighting the losses of taking one choice over the other. And I'm not sure if I'm expressing this correctly. But what I wanted to ask you, in her study at Dartmouth, Keller, focusing on new employees and using these principles, increased participation rates in a voluntary supplemental retirement plan from 7% to 50%. So can you explain EAC to us and how the use of the model improves our savings behavior? You know, in response to some of what you were saying before, you can't just say, it's not enough to say you have to save money. It's about helping people do that well and wisely.
Yeah, so I'm going to actually answer that question by answering one that you didn't ask me and then getting
excellent.
To that one, which is The automated features that we have in the retirement industry have been a great tool to help initiate people into savings or, you know, behaviors that they might not have already done. The disadvantage of those is they are directly, you know, opposed to this idea of empowering people to make informed financial choices, because what we're doing is we're eliminating the choice opportunity, essentially. We're automatically doing, putting people into retirement plans, into funds, into auto-escalation programs, and people don't understand those. They don't understand the impact. So they're not empowered, and they're not in control of their decision-making, really. So that's one part of it. So you see a lot of interesting behaviors now being associated with auto features, such as lower savings rates, lower rates of engagement, people not even being aware that they're participating in a 401k plan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what Professor Keller has been working on is a way to facilitate people making decisions that are in their own best interest. And it's really a simple idea, which is so traditionally the way that we inform people about benefits programs that are available to them is we say, here's the program, here's all the ways, here's all the things that happen, here's all the benefits and features, do you want to sign up? That's kind
right.
of the story. In Professor Keller's model, we're seeking to empower the individual to make an informed decision about this financial choice. And the way that we do that is to highlight the advantages of the optimal choice and the consequences of the suboptimal choice. So then it has some kind of context in the user or the participant's or individual's life. So if I make this decision to participate in this plan or this feature or whatever it is, I'm making the decision, a positive decision, to help myself have a more financially secure future. If I decline this offer, I am choosing that I risk not having enough money and I might put my financial future in jeopardy. Nobody wants to make that choice. And we force them into making the binary choice. Which one of these things do you want? And that makes the person stop and think about what it is that they're doing. And that's where you really see a big increase in voluntary savings elections and savings behavior. We've actually taken Professor Keller's work, and he's actually a partner with NARP, and we've integrated it into a completely re-envisioned way of educating and informing people about their financial decisions. And it's called intuitive sustained engagement. So it's a combination of Professor Keller's research with EAC, and then we combine that with human-centered or intuitive design so that we can quickly use visual imagery to help bring people to a higher level of knowledge about a difficult concept. And we're seeing great results with it.
Yeah, and as an aside to that, I encourage listeners to go to NARP's website, which is NARPP.org, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Because there are, we cannot show some of the visuals, but for those of you who are responsible for communications around any challenging decision, or particularly this challenging decision, you will note some significant differences in the visual way that NARP communicates that I particularly, as a communication consultant, found winning and compelling.
Thank you. Go ahead.
No, and I want to take us back to a comment you made about looking at people's lives holistically, because as I was going through these, as I said, several hundred questions that I got from employers, and also looking at the employers represented on the panel, which included Keurig Green Mountain, Chipotle, Mexican Grill, and Nelnet, which, interestingly enough, is a large government contractor that handles college loans. So you would think pretty financially savvy. They also represent a fair amount of employees who are fairly low wage, and in some mm-hmm. cases where English is not their first language, and mm-hmm. they feel fairly financially distressed. And so a lot mm-hmm. of the questions that came, and including these employers, tried to talk about it a little bit, but without a lot of good solutions. So I'm hoping maybe you have some ideas. There were a lot of comments and questions from employers who said that their employees need help with really some basic stuff. They need help with mm-hmm. budgeting. They need help with day-to-day financial challenges in their lives.
Yeah.
And they need this help before they can even consider retirement. And so their question was, as an employer, you know, how do I address this immediate financial tension that my employees feel in concert with trying to help them plan for their long-term financial future?
Yeah, so that's a complicated question with an answer that is going to be even a little bit more complicated, which is that the way that the benefits are set up now, they go through your employer. And people have, you know, we've done a lot of research on how people view their employer, how much trust they have with their employer, et cetera. So you're talking about all of the benefits that are, you know, your health and financial benefits are coming through your employer. This is not really an ideal place to start saying things like, I need a budget. I don't understand any of these financial concepts. People don't want to talk about that with their employer. I mean, you know, in this job market, people are happy to have jobs. They want to put their best foot forward. This isn't really the most conducive environment for helping people, you know, take control of their financial lives or help them, you know, with these types of activities. This is not employers' core competency. And there's some tension and some friction there between what we're asking people to do and the context in which we're asking them to do it. So then the other player that's been involved are the service providers. You know, there's a lot of service providers that have, you know, budgeting tools and, you know, various things available on their websites and so forth, but they don't really get used. And if you look at some of the reasons why there, service providers are in the difficult position of both selling products and educating. And with trust in financial institutions at an all-time low, it makes it very difficult for people to engage with those tools and resources. Because people have the perception that if they reach out for financial help, they're going to be sold a product, which may or may not be true, but that's the overwhelming perception. So let's just live with that as it is. So let's just meet people where they are. They need help with financial planning, tools, budgeting, how to get out of debt, how to even become a saver. And that's really where, you know, that's actually one of the reasons that we started NARP, because we realized that there needs to be a place that's dedicated to helping the individual that isn't, you know, that doesn't have any really skin in the game. Our goal is to help you become more financially independent and make better financial decisions. If you need help with budgeting, if you need help of getting out of debt or making a plan of how to save, we see ourselves as sort of that resource that helps prepare people or start on the path or help them wherever they are, actually, to make better financial decisions. Right now, there isn't really a space for that in the industry. You know, employers have the whole responsibility, and some employers to varying degrees care or don't care about their employees' financial health. So that's the other aspect. That's why I said it's kind of a complicated answer. And then you have, of course, the other point that complicates everything is that people change jobs frequently. So let's say you're working with one of those employers, and they're offering a great, you know, they have a bunch of tools and resources that they make available to help you with your financial planning, and then you get a different job, and they don't offer anything.
Mm-hmm.
So then what do you do? You know, so we have to start viewing these experiences through the participants or the user's eyes and how they're experiencing, you know, their interaction with their own financial life. Because to them, it's just their finances, but to the outside world, sort of employers and service providers, they sort of look at them in different kind of fragmented states. That's why the holistic part of, you know, we have to take a more holistic view of the individual.
Yeah, I agree with you. And there was an op-ed piece yesterday in the Wall Street Journal saying, you know, calling for a prediction that perhaps we're going to start to see the wind down of employee benefits. Now, other surveys point differently, but their case in point was where we've watched the evolution of the, you know, the demise of the traditional pension product and the movement to 401ks and 403bs, and that now with the ACA, which you can argue in many ways is a financial product, it helps you handle the cost of healthcare. We're going to start to see that as even sometimes a better option than what people can get from their employers. So maybe we are going to march to a world where employers just hand you a bolus of money and kind of say, good luck, Godspeed, you know, just put it in your salary and call it good. And so then there is
and then there's
really no place
then
for
there's
people
the tension.
Go.
Oh, sorry, Carol. And then there's
no, go ahead.
the
other research, like from MetLife, who's been tracking loyalty and appreciation for employers who do provide benefits. So in contrast, Lori, to what you're saying, there's some data that says that employees are very grateful for their employers giving them access to financial education, financial counseling, and other programs, and that increases their loyalty to their company. And that changes by generation in terms of what they're looking for and what they need and want.
Yeah, that's a great point. We just did a study with about 5,000 participants, and we asked them how they felt about their benefit. When you look at that data by age, you can really see the older generation. So people, I hate to say this because I guess I'm now part of the older generation almost.
Welcome to the club.
have a much higher level of appreciation for the benefit than their lower age cohort. So we look at 30 and under, and they say, yeah, it's a nice thing, but, you know, it's not, it's under 50% of people think it's, you know, they highly value it. So you do see a decline in the valuing of these benefits. And part of that may be because of younger workers are all auto-enrolled in these programs, so they're not even aware that they're even, you know, what it means and the benefit of the benefits.
Right, and it could be even changing expectations about what we're going to get from work and how long we're going to stick with it. But
correct.
I wanted to plumb into something else from your research that I noted. So in the opening of our show, I was talking about the lack of confidence people feel about their readiness for retirement. And most of us really feel lack of confidence and knowledge about personal finance in general. In your research, I noted that nearly half of the vendors produce materials that have successfully eliminated jargon. And I found that actually surprising.
Yeah.
That seemed like a high number, better than I would have thought. Your research found that only 26% of plan participants possess a deep understanding of the benefits of their company saving plan, and 21% know how to achieve their long-term goals. Now, my question was going to be, where's the breakdown happening? I got a little sense of that in your feelings about auto-enrollment, that the distance between our what's happening to us and our active involvement in what's happening to us could be part of that, could be part of where that distance is. But if jargon is not or is only part of the issue, what else is going on?
Well, there's a big issue around with both employers and with participants about trust. So we've just done, and we haven't released this study data yet, so I'll just tell you right now for the first time ever, we have made a huge link in our analysis between education is something that, so communications, which I would consider anything to do with education. So trust is driving engagement, and engagement in terms of using resources, using, you know, tools, figuring out how much you need for retirement, all of those things that we associate with good retirement savings behavior to get people confidence about their knowledge levels, all of those things are being driven by engagement. Engagement is being driven by trust. Trust is very low. So if you have low trust, you have low engagement. When you have low engagement, you have low confidence. And when you start to unravel it that way, it starts to make a lot of sense why engagement rates are really low and why people have a low level of financial knowledge and why people feel, you know, not a lot of confidence, because people are participating in a financial program that they have no say in. Their employer decided who's going to administer that plan. So you're asking me to put my life savings in a plan that I have no control over, that I made no decision about, that I have no say in, and I'm supposed to trust these people to tell me what to do to help me live out my, you know, retirement years. So the whole experience is completely disempowering, and if we go back to the original question that you asked me about what financial wellness is, about making empowered, informed choices, you know, the situation with not making empowered choices around which, you know, plans and who you have to work with vis-a-vis your employer is a disempowering exercise for many people.
You know, Lori, you're making me reflect on other shows and discussions we've had about private exchanges, which right now are only open to health benefits, and we're starting to see some ancillary benefits out there. But it's in many ways the first step for employers to give employees this bolus of money. Get them to a group platform where, for not something like retirement, but for other products where they can still take advantage of the group rates. So the thing that I look at, particularly with having a specialty in ancillary products that are complementary, in my opinion, to retirement products, the tough part for us, you know, versus retirement is if you don't get the benefit through your employer, you go into a much more expensive product
outside of the
employment scenario. So how do we address those larger things where you, if we do start moving away from an employer-based service, how do we give people access to good financial help but not move them to an individual platform?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of room right now for this is an exciting time, actually, to try and figure out that model. I don't think anyone has it exactly. But going back to your point about the fees on doing your own individual retirement account and how much that costs you, you know, the only people really getting great fee amounts on their 401k plans are people who are in really large plans. The smaller plans, which are the majority of plans in the country, you know, have pretty high fees. A lot of them have almost retail rate fees. And to just complicate the matter even further, most people participating in 401k plans don't know they're paying fees. They don't think they're paying any fees whatsoever on their plan. So we just did a study 3 weeks ago, 5,000 participants. Only 40% of current people participating in a 401k plan think they're paying any fees at all. And of that 40%, only 20% could accurately identify how the fees were calculated. So, you know, the issue with fees is complicated and how we do that, but I think just because I don't think that's a reason to not explore the idea of private exchanges. You know, I think that there's a way to make that work from a fee perspective that would be probably more beneficial if somebody was engaged in saving and active in their own choices as opposed to not saving at all. Or bouncing between employer to employer and having, you know, cashing out plans and not rolling them over and doing a bunch of things that are going to be detrimental to their long-term savings health.
Well, what I'm hearing through our course of... go ahead, Carol.
Please, Sharon, go ahead.
What I'm hearing through the course of our conversation is that, coming back to our theme of financial well-being, is that not only is it enough to have the safety and the security to make your everyday goals or everyday needs and bills and pay them, but be prepared for the next. But it's the idea of being actively able and knowledgeable to do that with some confidence and ease. I think that that's a really good theme for us to walk away with and add to our definition of financial well-being as we continue to explore this. I know that we're coming up to the top of our 30 minutes, and so what I would love to do is move us to the final question that we talk to all of our guests, or we ask all of our guests, and it's one thing that helps us explore the great ideas that didn't work out. So we'd like to ask you if you could share with us a great idea you had that didn't quite work out as envisioned and what you took away from that.
You know, my entire career has been a bunch of decisions that didn't work out exactly how I had planned them for.
You're not alone.
That's right, exactly.
I would say that, you know, I was thinking about this, I think the thing that's important about things not working out is to be okay with that. So what I mean by that is, I've seen many times over the course of my 25-year career in retirement savings and working with a lot of service providers and various organizations that people get an idea in their head about something they want to have happen, and they make a plan for it, and they go forward with it. And then something happens, and it kind of goes off course, and it doesn't work. And people, you know, are very reluctant to iterate or make changes or course correct. So people become really dogmatic in their approach of how to implement their ideas. And I think part of failure or something not working out the way you want it is an incredible learning experience to say, where did I go wrong in my understanding of the situation in a way that I can tactically shift or pivot to better address whatever goal or outcome I was trying to achieve. And so my take on failure is welcome it. Like, try things that are new, take risks, try on new things. That's how we make real change. And that can entails a bit of courage, but if you can do it with a way of being okay with it not working out and being flexible with it, I think that helps you achieve your goal, whatever your intention was of starting off on that course in the first place.
Yeah, what I continue to hear from people as they talk about this is the idea that, you know, if only we need to have the confidence to look at failure as not our failure, not us being a failure, but that there's something to take away from what shifted that can help us, or that didn't pan out, that if we look at it correctly, it helps us to be stronger and more confident going forward.
Yeah, I mean, because there's not always one way of doing something, and so you can try things, and that's how we advance as a society, right? We try different things on, and that works, and that didn't, and then we change and modify, and then we get to a place that's really helping, you know, it's really achieving an end goal when you do that. I think when you become really rigid, I think that's the kiss of death.
You know, what you're saying, Lori, reminds me of two things. There was an attempt on Twitter for a while with a hashtag called FLEARN, FLEARN, which the purpose was fail so you can learn. And
yeah.
It came from the idea that we aren't comfortable talking publicly about our failures. And my original roots are scientific research. And you've probably seen, because it's made it into the public media, that, you know, in order to get published, you've got a, you know, 75% chance you'll get published if you're publishing a success. But if you try to publish a hypothesis that failed, your odds of that getting published are abysmal, you know, to maybe 15%.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think what you're calling for is what, as Fran said, everyone's calling for, is we have to get more comfortable talking about our failures so other people can learn, not just us, you know, other people can learn.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think people have to actually get comfortable with the idea of themselves failing. For some reason, I'm okay with that. I don't know why. I started my first company when I was 19.
Yeah, you have to have a very good sense of humor, I think, to be able to embrace it and to realize that, wow, that really didn't go right.
right. Yeah.
Well, Lori, I see that we are indeed at the bottom of our show, and we Fran and I want to thank you so much for joining us, and of course for the people who both listen live and will listen on a going forward basis. So thank you so much for kicking off the CoHealth series on financial well-being. Couldn't think of a better person to do that.
Thank you.
And we also Oh, it's just a complete pleasure on our part. And we want to remind people again to go to the NARP website, which is narpp.org, to continue to get good information on this topic. We also want to tell our listeners that our next show is going to be on Wednesday, June 3rd at 12 noon Eastern Daylight Time. Our guest is going to be Doug Hirsch, who's the founder of GoodRx, a company which has evolved in a very interesting way over the last 3 years on how to control your financial well-being around prescriptive drugs. And I think that will be very useful to both consumers and people who are in the employer space. You can listen to today's show as well as all of our shows on demand at your leisure through the Blog Talk Radio platform, but you can also listen through iTunes and Stitcher. So once again, thank you, Lori Rowley. Thank you, Fran Melmed. And thank you to our listeners.
Thank you so much.